issue. And then in 1947-48, some according to the court, miscreants within courts placed the idol of Lord Rama inside the mosque, and which caused more trouble. And ever since, the Hindutva parties and RSS have turned this mosque temple issue into the national issue. I mean, if you remember, in 1992, BJP had all of 2 seats. In the more than 500 seat Lok Sabha or lower house of the parliament, but by 96 they had more than 150 because of the violence, the destruction of the mosque, and all the violence that it entailed all across India. In fact, that was the first time BJP came to power. It installed its first prime minister in India, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, whose government didn't last many days at that time, but they kept coming back to power. And there was a break after 2004, but it also led to further experimentation in majoritarianism. And one of the most gruesome of those was in Gujarat. In 2002, when his party, which was in power at that time, turned a blind eye to ethnic cleansing of Muslims from Gujarat by Hindutva radicals. According to reports at that time, it was claimed that close to 5,000 Muslims were killed. Later, the government said it was only 3,000. Then, more recently, they've been saying it was only 1,000. But what it led to was an effective apartheid in that part of India, where Muslims were excluded from mainstream spaces. And Modi, who was the chief minister of that time, and his, you know, acolyte Amit Shah, who were part of the governance structure, rose to national prominence. Modi, up until he became the prime minister in 2014, was a persona non grata in the United States. But once he became the prime minister, of course, all of those things went away. Amit Shah became the home minister. And they've been carrying out these experiments. Every time there's a election, riots break out across different parts of India. Pogroms against Muslims break out. So Babri Masjid was like sort of a key element story in that.
You're listening to Mohammed Junaid on Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Critical articles about Kashmir are few and far between in the Indian media, and I should add, even in the U.S. Western media. There are threats and attacks on journalists and censorship. Even the vaunted BBC came under the wrath of the Modi regime. Their offices were raided in Delhi. Foreign journalists are denied entry, as I was in 2011, or are deported. Samrat Chaudhary, writing in Le Monde Diplomatique, says, Modi's government has muzzled India's media through arrests, tax raids, and other uses of arbitrary powers. Only a few brave independent news sources exist. So what about the media in India today vis-a-vis Kashmir?
Most of what is called the national media in India, which is privately owned, is supportive of whatever Modi is doing. And this includes both English as well as Hindi medium media. The BJP has been able to not only co-opt them, but coerce them as well. Historically on Kashmir, media has had a consensus in India. You know, it's like, as I said, Kashmir has always been in a state of exception to the broader story in South Asia. But at least there was some level of freedom previously, where you could see occasional voices who would oppose the government. But now, if you watch India's news channels, you'd feel like they are like the public relations officers of the regime. They also claim that India is entering what Modi has called the Amrit Kal, this great era of Indian civilization that is now going to last 1,000 years of Hindu dominance, and where the influence of the Mughals and the British and everybody has been wiped clean. The media keeps has become an echo chamber. Everybody is falling over each other to be seen as more loyal to Modi than the other one. Within this climate, you know, it's very hard for people. I mean, Kashmir was already hard, but even in India, to report objectively, to report even human interest stories that might appear critical of the Modi regime. You know, I mean, foreign journalists find it difficult to agree with what Modi is saying unless they are like part of some, you know, business newspapers who like would like to do business in India. And, I mean, more recently, I've seen a series of people, not only people who are like foreigners, but people of Indian origin have what is called the OCI, Overseas Citizen of India, which allows them to travel. It's a lifetime thing that it allows them to come to India, to live there, to have a job. But they have been deported. A series of them have been deported from India. So yeah, we're getting into a much more repressive state than ever before. And clearly, there seems to be no end to it at this stage.
And the government, Modi's regime, has run a sustained PR campaign about itself and all the wonders of globalization and economic capitalism. But those who resist Delhi's rule are called terrorists and agents of neighboring Pakistan. In terms of international law, though, people under occupation have the right to resist.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, but Indian government does not care about international law or international norms anymore. Previously, it was Kashmiris who were called Pakistani-sponsored. Now, even Congress people, I mean, who used to call Kashmiris Pakistani-sponsored, they are even told that they should go to Pakistan if they are critical of Modi. So it seems that for Hindutva, Pakistan has like too much power over India, which obviously is completely untrue. It's easy for a regime like Modi to claim everybody is supported by Pakistan who does not agree with him.
I want you to talk about two terms, Atut Ang and Azadi.
Atut Ang is the term that Kashmir is an inalienable part of India. It is this organic imagination of India as Bharat Mata, the mother goddess India, and who Hindu nationalists and other nationalists in India have always claimed that Kashmir is the crown that, you know, well, Kashmiris have never had that imagination. Kashmir historically was never part of India. There was no India in, for that matter, you know, as it exists now. The South Asia had always been this layered geography of sovereignties. Sometimes empires would emerge, then they would disappear. And Kashmir has a much longer history of being an independent entity than being under any imperial control. So for Kashmiris, Azadi means freedom. It also means freedom not only in the political sense of like having sovereignty, having control of its own affairs, but also means freedom from hierarchy, freedom from this India's underlying caste system, because India has, you know, caste is a big issue in India. It's a structuring element of the state. Hindutva is the ideology of the upper castes. And for them, to maintain the caste order, they need to maintain the Indian state as an empire. For Kashmiris, to get out of that caste order means to get rid of the Indian state's control over their lives. So those are interlinked projects. Azadi is freedom in a sovereign political sense, but also in a progressive sense, freedom from this hierarchical arrangement that has been imposed on them.
The Hindutva crowd was telling Indian Muslims, you know, it's Pakistan ya Kabristan. You have a choice. You can go to Pakistan or you can wind up in the cemetery dead.
Yeah, and this is a slogan since 1947 and 46, actually. Indian Muslims, many of them perhaps, you know, either could not leave for Pakistan in 1947 because they were geographically dispersed, or they would have to give up so much of their belongings to and destroy their kinship relations to be in Pakistan. And many made a voluntary choice to stay in India. They did believe in at that time that India could become a secular place where they would be respected, or they would have equal citizenship, that even though there might be tensions, occasionally intercommunal tensions, but the state would be neutral enough to be an honest broker and a protector of the minorities. Of course, those have fallen flat. Those ideas have not turned out to be true. India can under no imagination be seen as a secular state anymore. You know, it has turned into a majoritarian ethnocracy. And in the BJP regime has erased Muslims from India's history, you know, Muslim influence from Indian history. They have disenfranchised them. When I say minority, you know, Muslims and minority, this in actual numbers, this is close to 200 million people. That's like more than half of United States population that has been effectively disenfranchised.
What's your sense, if there were a plebiscite today, how would that vote go? Do you think Kashmiris would opt for unification with Pakistan or some kind of independence, autonomy within the Indian Union?
If there was an option of independence, I think that most Kashmiris would vote for that. But in the absence of an option for independence, they would vote for some kind of an arrangement with Pakistan.
Talk about India's growing alliance with Israel. Aparna Gopalan in these times in an article entitled Israel, India, and the Ethno-Nationalist Right. She writes, India has used Israeli drones, rifles, surveillance systems, fighter jets, bombs, and cybersecurity in its occupation of Kashmir, but has trained its security forces in Israel and borrowed Israeli tactics such as, in quotes, surgical strike raids. What about that growing relationship? And you've reported on a very unusual comment from the Indian Consul General in New York.
When I returned to the U.S., and some diaspora Kashmiris were very concerned about their relatives back home, and so they were organizing, trying to ask the U.S. government to tell the, you know, Indian government to reopen the internet in Kashmir. We came across a clip which somebody has shared that the Indian Consul General in New York was meeting some Hindu activists in the U.S. and telling them, we're going to do to Kashmiris what Israel is doing to Palestine, which is precisely what August 5 was about, the initiation of the settler colonialism. Modi and Netanyahu are quite buddies. They share a close relationship. And there is also a lot of affinity between Hindutva groups and Zionists. You know, after this Israeli assaults in Gaza, some of the biggest supporters of Israel are Indian trolls on social media. And there are many Indians who have expressed an interest in going to fight on Israel's behalf. The Hindutva activists have often argued that what Israel is doing to Gazans and Palestinians in general is what India should be doing to Kashmiris and Muslims in general across India. Now, the relationship is ideological. I mean, there's a mutual ideology of hatred that they share towards Muslims. You know, that's one element of it. The second is that both Zionism and Hindutva share a similar sort of supremacist victim ideology, where they simultaneously claim to be supremacist. You know, they want to impose their vision on their occupied people or their subject populations, while they also draw the inspiration for this from the history of victimization. For Zionists, that is the whatever happened to them in Europe, from pogroms to Holocaust. For Hindutva, it's harder to find that in history. So they have to invent figures like the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb and other Muslim rulers of medieval India to and claim that they had done terrible things to the Hindus. Like Babri Masjid, for instance, is a classic example of this narrative where they believe that Babur, one of the first Mughal emperor, had tasked one of his generals to destroy a pre-existing temple to build a mosque there. Well, but of course history doesn't bear this. Archaeological Survey of India, despite their best efforts, could never find any evidence. And they did find a temple somewhere close by, but that had been either destroyed by natural ravages. And there was no evidence that Lord Rama was either an actual historical figure or born there.
A constant argument the Indian state uses against the perfidious, in their view, Kashmiris, is the treatment of Kashmiri Hindus, pundits, in the early 1990s. What about that?
Kashmiri pundits have gone through a lot. Many of them left in the early years of this mass upsurge against the Indian state. Of course, the movement was not directed against the Kashmiri Hindus. Kashmir has 95% Muslims and 3-4%, historically speaking, Kashmiri pundits. Most of these were Brahmins. So Hindus and Muslims in Kashmir have historically been closely entwined. They share the same language, many of similar traditions, culture. But there was a fear among Kashmiri pundits about what would this upsurge against the Indian state mean. Because many of the Kashmiri pundits believed that they needed the Indian state to protect them. You know, Pakistan took over Kashmir. In 1990, January to be precise, when Kashmiri pundits left, and now many of them claim that they left out of fear. Kashmiri Muslims would argue, for instance, that it was the governor of that time, Jagmohan, who told pundits to leave and he was going to roll the tanks on Muslims and they could come back at the end of the winter. But that end never came. You know, more people that this guy killed, more the insurgency kind of expanded. And now we're like 32 years later, and although a small number of Kashmiri Hindus have continued to remain, I think around 7,000 families, and they've lived throughout there, and even Tehrik leaders have often asked Kashmiri pundits to return to their homes, but as some of my Kashmiri pundit, you know, scholar colleagues have said, Kashmiri pundit suffering has been weaponized by the Indian state, especially by Hindutva, against both Muslims in India and as well as Kashmiris in general.
Suvir Kaul, a Kashmiri pundit who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, in his book Of Gardens and Graves writes, "The future, certainly the possibility of a political resolution of the problem of Kashmir," he says, "looks bleak. India grows increasingly powerful economically and militarily, and its aspirations towards regional superpower status means that its strategic planners will deny any possibility of self-determination for Kashmiris." What do you think of Kaul's analysis?
I think that, you know, Kashmiris cannot afford to be hopeless because it's a struggle for survival. I mean, what else can we do but continue to like seek our freedom? The other option would be to just die, which is what Indian state would probably want. I mean, I don't agree with these bleak worldviews.
Washington has been looking the other way while Modi fuels rampant Islamophobia and human rights abuses. It's silent about Kashmir. Why?
India has been now projected as this frontline state against China. Although India was expected to do more than that, on, for instance, Russia-Ukraine question, India has continued to defy Washington. It's become one of the biggest purchasers of Russian oil. In terms of China, U.S. hopes that if they can arm India, if they can prep India to be the frontline state, they don't have to do the fighting themselves. And secondly, India has a middle class now. It's a very small percentage of the population, but in sheer numbers, it's a large section of the people. They travel globally and they consume products. For these reasons, U.S. has been mostly silent on what is going on in India.
State oppression in Kashmir and elsewhere in India, I may add, is cloaked in such laws as the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, known by the acronym AFSPA, and the Public Safety Act. Talk about these so-called legal mechanisms of control.
Both of these, AFSPA and PSA, are colonial-era laws. When I mean colonial, I mean British colonial-era laws. They were imposed in frontier regions where the British believed that they did not have, they could not have indirect control. They needed much more authority for their armed forces to act with impunity. Public Safety Act has its roots in apartheid South Africa. It allowed for, preventative detention of activists, thinkers, writers, and who had then no recourse to any legal measures. And these tactics, India has continued. These remain on the books. Kashmir is officially considered to be a disturbed area in the Indian, legal lexicon. But what it means is that while the Indian military has committed huge human rights abuses over the last few decades, there have been very few, if any, proceedings against the Indian armed officers or soldiers for those violations.
You teach here in the United States. People here know very little about Kashmir. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that one of the things that I have realized is that we cannot afford America, which has such a huge global influence and plays a big, overwhelming role in maintaining the order that there exists, the imperial order, that we cannot afford American public to be ignorant about these issues, because they do play a big role. And I'm hopeful. I mean, I'm seeing these young people coming out to protest against the Israeli actions in Gaza, against what they are doing. It's quite heartening to see that the newer generation is becoming more aware of the destructive policies of these rogue actors around the world and how the U.S. government keeps supporting them. We need to keep educating people about what is happening in Kashmir, because what is happening in Kashmir, what's happening in Palestine, what's happening in Nagorno or Kurdistan, what's happening all around the world to indigenous peoples is part of the same chain of colonialism that has never ended.
In Kashmiri Futures, you and your co-authors Deepti Misri and Atharazia write, I'm quoting, "Kashmir is in a moment when imagining alternative futures looks difficult, even absurd. Yet it is precisely at this moment that continuing to imagine such futures becomes a radical act."
Absolutely. I think, as I said, we cannot afford to not continue to resist, because if we did stop, it will mean we stop existing. So imagining the futures, imagining possibilities, imagining alternative ways of belonging and being in the world is a radical act, because, we are being told that accept this as the reality now, the reality of power, the dominance and hegemony and imperialism are the future in which we are going to live. Either you are, the Bush's logic, or either you are with us or against us. I think, people in Kashmir and elsewhere don't want to be with us or against us. They just want to be something else. They don't want to be determined by these colonial relations.
You know, given what we've talked about, the hundreds of thousands of Indian troops in Kashmir, the abrogation of Article 370, all of these negative impacts on Kashmiri people, what in the end gives you hope that things will change for the better?
Kashmir's history is a long one. We have had several periods throughout that history where foreign occupiers, autocrats, killers, mercenaries have come and tried to dominate the place. But at the end, the Kashmiris have sort of survived. All of that experience have left traumas and pain behind, but Kashmiris have survived. That tradition is strong enough. We also believe now that we live in a much more interconnected world where the forces of oppression are also tied together, right? I mean, they share logistics and information about how to dominate subject populations, but so are the people who are resisting. You know, they're learning about each other's struggles, and I think that gives me hope too.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, David.
You were just listening to Mohammed Junaid on Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir. I talked with him in Boulder, Colorado. Mohammed Junaid has written on Kashmir in various journals and magazines. He teaches at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Sarah Scholes, Eugene Perrier, Ralph Nader, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And we have a series of programs on Kashmir. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Mohammed Junaid on Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir, and for Arundhati Roy's new book, The Architecture of Modern Empire, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
On average, every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by her intimate partner. The women in our communities deserve to feel safe from both emotional and physical abuse. They deserve men who control their anger. Most importantly, they deserve to know the people they love most will never hurt them. Men like me stand up to create a safer world for the women in our lives. And we're looking to men like you, the men who make up our communities, to join us. You can play an active part to end violence. Visit www.whiteribbon.ca.